Thanks a lot. So I'm going to be telling you about, I like to call it the first new physics at the LHC. After some discoveries have been made, we have compelling evidence for new physics and start to try to characterize it. But at the same time, we don't have enough of an idea what's going on to start doing any precision physics. So the first order of business is really to get some qualitative properties of the new physics spectrum. And that's important for two reasons. One is to start motivating the next stage of analyses, set the stage for precision physics. And the other is to start now probing the questions that we really care about, the questions that motivated building the LHC, questions of understanding the TV scale, dark matter, electroweak symmetry breaking, and so on. So the bulk of this talk will be about some ideas and progress on how to get there. But first I want to dispel one other question, which is why not just wait and do all of this later? That's certainly relevant, and you don't want to waste your time doing things too generally when you'll know much more precisely once there's data. But two things that I think make it worthwhile are, first, that we want to have an understanding of which methods we can trust for drawing conclusions. The only way to do that is by going through some examples and thinking about it. The second is going back to these eventual goals, really understanding the basic physics. I think any of us who have tried to understand the implications of Tevatron results for new physics models have found that, you know, there's a lot of good data, there's a lot of very good constraints, but many of them are hard to use because they're presented in a sort of ambiguous, very model-specific way. And it's important to get beyond that, and it'll be even more important when there are signals to characterize, not just exclusions. So the whole goal of this talk is really to think about how to characterize early data by identifying consistent processes, also by figuring out what processes are inconsistent, and by constraining the rates of different processes and the masses of the particles that go into them. If you do this right, it should be easy to compare to any model of new physics, and that's really our goal. And I just want to say this isn't completely trivial. There are other methods that don't look at it this way. For example, studying kinematic features is extremely useful. In early data, it's mostly restricted to leptons, talking about things like edges and endpoints. And that means it's not really sufficient, in many cases, to get the full picture. Another thing that's often done is a scan of a parameter space of a model, usually a small model like M-SUGRA, just for computational reasons. And this assumes a lot of relations that are imposed among masses, between masses and other parameters. And all of them can reasonably be violated in completely reasonable models. And figuring out what the constraints mean outside of the specific regime that you studied is often difficult. So we'll take this process approach, and I just want to say the biggest challenge facing any interpretation is the standard model and really understanding the backgrounds. But I'm not going to talk about that too much because, in fact, I'm barely going to give it the credit it deserves in this talk, because I'm really going to focus on the challenges that come from confronting the complexity of new physics that we expect to see, confronting the number of possibilities, which is really something we don't have experience with at hadron colliders. The Z, the W, and the top were much simpler processes in terms of their decay than we expect from SUSY, for instance, and they were also very well constrained theoretically. So when you try to confront those possibilities, I think there's a couple of obstacles and challenges that become clear. The first is being able to simulate an arbitrary process as simply as possible, not just the processes you think are there, but the processes you think are unreasonable and you really want to convince yourself that they're not there. Also, to constrain the processes using whatever you have. And when there are no sharp edges and endpoints to use, you need to use broader, vaguer features however you can. And it's important to make sure that you can actually do this. You're not just talking, blowing hot air. Thirdly, you have a lot of possibilities when you think this way, and you need at least a starting point to try to cover. To really turn this into a reasonable plan for how to start understanding new physics data. So I'm going to develop each of those 3 points. I'm going to give you a very quick review of a simple framework for characterizing processes, building collections of them, called on-shell effective theories. And we can simulate any process in that framework. Some work with members of the CMS group here at UCSB on testing the realism of these broad constraints and testing them with backgrounds, developing some useful tools for it. And the third thing is a set of collections of mutually consistent processes that go together to cover a sort of consistent conservative section of the MSSM. And I'm going to try to tie all of this together back to really understand extracting physics from early data and what we can learn about SUSY dark matter, at least qualitatively, in fairly early analysis. So that'll just be a brief example at the end. I think we'll tie everything together. Okay, so we want to describe processes as simply, as stupidly as possible so that we start with this, so we can start simple and not worry about the possibilities. What's the stupidest way to talk about top? Well, the stupidest thing that works is you produce two tops, they decay according to phase space, and the appropriate parametrization for 2-to-2 production that simplest you can get away with is basically constant. You can see here many different matrix elements for particles of different spins, and blue is a constant. PT distributions don't change very much. And this is just a consequence of the threshold domination and homogeneity of the PDFs that Nima actually talked about this morning. And there's also some systematic, very clean corrections one can put in to deal with more asymmetric kinematics where these corrections can be important. So this is really just, as I said, the dumbest starting point that isn't ludicrously dumb. It's useful to start from that in many cases. So it models a collection of processes that you can consider independently because we don't need to keep track of matrix elements anymore because we're using these stupid parametrized productions in decays. This is all in Monte Carlo and available. And the idea, of course, is to reintroduce the detailed dynamics whenever you either start probing it experimentally or have some very well-motivated sharp guess. Now, all of this is a little bit silly to start developing as a lone theorist talking about what to do with early data that isn't yours. So we wanted to test its sensibility, understand limitations, and for that, we worked through some early analysis scenarios with Joan Candela, Sue Ann Coy, and Roberto Rosen, and we here means me and another theorist, Philip Schuster. And we really worked through from having a signal that was seen over a standard model background, simulated somewhat realistically, similarly to the way CMS will simulate in actual running, and going all the way through to trying to characterize the processes. So this is just a brief montage of that process, and some of the questions that we encountered, the issues that we encountered along the way, trying to ask what processes are consistent with the data, which ones are mutually consistent with each other, and what's a sort of reasonable way to branch through it to really track back your steps, understand how much you've covered, how much you've ruled out. This really motivated the work that I'll tell you about in a minute about systematizing the important processes of supersymmetry. But before that, I want to talk about the technical obstacles. These are really the need to do standard tasks in a slightly non-standard setting, namely trying to characterize processes. Standard tasks like setting limits on a model or scanning parameters to find the best fit. Now, people do this all the time in top physics, in W physics, and in BSM physics, but we want to do it here in as general a setting as possible. So, of course, we want to try to do it simply as well. And so with them, we developed a set of analysis tools for CMS use that tackle these problems, and I'd like to illustrate their use in the context of why do we actually care? As far as end result physics, why do we care about having this kind of technology around? And why are they an important step in trying to extract basic physics from the data? So these tools are all available to CMS with documentation and examples. We're running a little mini course with our CMS collaborators at CMS this summer on working on a public note. Okay, so one of the first things that you run into is you want to know roughly what's inconsistent with the data. And in our scenario, okay, there were some properties, there were Bs, there was missing energy, there were leptons. Without going into the details, It looked pretty qualitatively consistent with Susie. But one thing we want to know is, how confident are we that it can't be other things? So you'd like to be able to try other guesses that seem to have some of the same properties. Example, could the missing energy be coming from neutrinos from TOPS? Never mind that we don't know what model would produce this. Can we convince ourselves that it's not that? And if we put in the same number of events for that hypothesis that were in the signal, you see that you're dramatically overpopulating some distributions in this graph. Now you might ask, why don't I just lower the mass of our new particle X? Of course, that would shift this distribution down, but it would also mess up the missing ET shape. So there's really a problem at any mass range. And the point at which you'd say this process is limited is when you're still probably overpopulating some region, but that could just be because the signal is a downward fluctuation from the 35% rate that we're talking about. There's also a region, a big region shown in blue, where you're underpopulating the signal, but this could well be some other process that goes along with it. So this 35% would be the most model-independent upper bound you can set on the process that I showed you at a particular mass value. Now, another case, much later in an analysis, where this again becomes relevant, is for looking for small rate processes. For example, in SUSY, if you have a heavy squark, it usually decays to the gluino. But sometimes, if it's a left-handed squark and there's a light gluino, it'll decay directly. And this can be a very interesting channel to search for, because it tells you whether there's a gluino present or not. Sometimes it's one of the easier ways to see that. But we might not necessarily know exactly the model. We have some kinematic guesses, though. So you really want to make the most general model-independent limit that you can set on this particular process with a direct squark decay to the gluino. And there's some kinematic differences that you can exploit. So one can try to do that. But I don't have any plots to show for that particular example. The second task that's important, again, completely standard, but very useful in this setting, is discriminating and trying to find the best range of parameters and the consistent ranges of parameters for different models. So, for example, if you think you have a lot of third-generation activity in both tops and bottoms in a decay chain, and you want to understand what combinations they're in, well, this would be the only combination, this and the four top, four bottom modes, the only things that can appear if there's no light chargino. If there's a nearly degenerate chargino present with the LSP, then you can get these modes that only have two tops, hence two Ws. And the main signature difference between these two is in the distributions of lepton counts. So you can study that and see, for instance, that the two lepton bin constrains the four top mode, because you have too high a rate of that and it would overpopulate two leptons. On the other hand, that forces you to keep this mode low and the zero lepton high. There's just not enough constraints. There's too many constraints to fit the arbitrary lepton data. Now, why can't we just ask the experimentalists for a plot of this and look at it as theorists ourselves? Well, one important issue is that the backgrounds are different in every bin, and I think we'd all feel much more comfortable trusting the experimentalists to study this and really give a robust conclusion. It doesn't have to have much model dependence. Then we can compare it to any model that interests us. This would be just a process level constraint. And you need to consider all of the possible branching ratios in the process. Another case is, again, process level thing that you extract from an interesting model, namely SUSY, is trying to distinguish associated production of a squark, a heavy squark and a gluino from the direct gluino production using the presence of this extra jet. Now, this is often hard unless the kinematics is really extreme. In this case, we get lucky for a different reason. Because the gluino decay products are mostly colored, we can really take advantage of the fact that that squark decay product is uncolored. And based on that observation, we can design the best observables to discriminate between these might take advantage of the differences in kinematics between tagged Jeffs and untagged Jeffs. You do that, you motivate a discriminator, and then you can place constraints on the fractions. Now, one of the nice things about setting it up this way is that varying fractions is extremely easy. It makes this part of the problem much easier because the processes are all independent. The mass of one particle doesn't affect the production cross-section for a different particle or the branching ratios. They're separate parameters. And of course, those constraints are real, and you can put them in, but it's easy, but it's optional, and you can do it naturally in a second stage. Mass scanning is also really important, and that is much more difficult. The tremendous simplification we had doesn't happen there. And we have a tool in progress to really handle different masses cleanly. It's being tested and refined right now. So what we're able to do here is we can simulate any process crudely, and we can study it as well. And now we face this enormous combinatorial problem. What processes do you want to study? And this is, of course, subjective. But for me personally, there's a clear answer, which is that it makes sense to start from conservative SUSY. Study that first until there's significant evidence to go elsewhere. But study it in as model-independent a way as you can so that the results that you get transfer elsewhere as you start generalizing your horizons in case it isn't garden variety MSSM. So we want some space that has the virtues of MSUGRA, that's a navigable parameter space that you can really scan and compare data to, but doesn't have the vices of rigidity of MSUGRA. And what I've been trying to do with Johan Allwall and Philip Schuster is make a list of essentially covers of conservative MSSM scenarios, basically collections of topologies that are mutually consistent that you expect to see together. And the natural way to divide this is into the SU3 sector, SU2 cross U1 sector, and then there's anything with very small couplings, things like gauge mediation, decays to Gravitino, R parity violating decays, typically are a separate element of this chain because they only affect the LSP or NLSP. Now, what I'm going to go through this very quickly, essentially just outlining these three pieces of the chain in a natural way. What makes this tricky is really trying to match the resolution of your cover to the resolution that you expect to have in early data. So you're not trying to distinguish between indistinguishable models too many times over, but you do want to cover the important visible differences. And of course, this furnishes, designed to furnish a good basis for SUSY, but you want it to work for non-SUSY models as well. So again, I hope I don't go through this too quickly. There's two SU3 structures in the first approximation. Either the Skork is heavier than the Gluino, or the Gluino is heavier than the Skork. And this affects kinematics, this affects heavy flavor fractions. In particular, you have more jets when the Skork is heavy than when the Gluino is heavy in the average event. SU2 structure, of course, the simplest is just having an invisible particle that you produce. You can also have cascade decays that typically give you either on or off shell WZs or Higgses, or lepton pairs from Slepton. There's a natural counterpart to this if you have a neutrino LSP or NLSP that one can also write down. And of course, you can go on and add more and more links to the chain. But this is really the starting point where you can hope to make progress with counts. And if there are long and lepton-rich cascades, you'll probably get evidence instead from kinematics. You need to advance further, and that's really the technique to push, not the counting methods that I'm describing here. And then there are these ultra-weak additions. You don't need to worry about R parity violating decays of a Skork in many cases because the coupling to the LSP is much larger. So if everything will decay down to the LSP, and then that will decay according to these things. So what I've presented so far, and I'm going to summarize it now because the rest of my talk will switch gears entirely, is a framework for model-independent characterization of new physics data. We have a useful simplification in modeling processes. There's also some tools for process-level model-independent analysis. These are in experimental hands, and development is continuing. There's a map, basic map between OSETs and SUSE processes with simple topology level building blocks and relatively few parameters. And this is something that naturally can be generalized to other models, just the data that would motivate you to do so. What this lets us do is build confidence in a process level description of the data and measure and bound the parameters of that description in a model independent way. Of course, what we eventually want to get from this, what I'd like to turn to now, is how to apply these techniques to actually understand something about TV scale physics. And to do that, I think this way of characterizing data really facilitates factorizing the problem of interpretation. And this isn't a sociological point, this is a physics point. Experimental data analysis is hard for one set of reasons. The interpretation in terms of models is difficult for a totally different set of reasons. And if they can be decoupled, you should, because then it's two times hard and not hard squared. So you want to have well understood and robust observables. It's also really important that that you choose observables as much as possible that have qualitative implications for the spectrum, qualitative implications for the consistent topologies, so that one can really extract lessons from the observables and then interpret them, phrased in a model-independent way, in some broader context. Broader could just mean going beyond MSUGRA, could mean looking at the end of SSM or Little Higgs. They should be applicable for any one of these because they have very similar topologies. Generically, it's hard to come up with observables that do everything you want. It's extremely hard. But you can get lucky. You can get lucky in many different ways. And so one should seek them out because they make life a lot easier. And I'm going to try to demonstrate both of these by thinking about LSP dark matter, which is, I think, one of the things that we can start getting a handle on at the LHC. I certainly won't try to be thorough about it, but I just want to go through this procedure and explain, you know, where's the end game in all of this? Why do I care about characterizing all these processes anyway? And I think the strongest statement that one could hope to get from just qualitative analysis, the qualitative analysis is only going to give you sort of plausible orders of magnitude for something like the relic density. It's not going to give you a number. So the most interesting thing you could learn is if you could from that kind of reasoning is if you could qualitatively rule out thermal dark matter from the LSP. And then this could mean that the dark matter is not thermal, it can mean that the MSSM is wrong, or it can mean that there's more than one type of dark matter. And all of these, I think, would be really interesting conclusions to draw. So the basic rules of thumb for dark matter for very low mass SUSE, which is what I'm talking about since we're thinking about early data, are that a pure light beano overcloses the universe because if it's generic, because it annihilates too little, whereas a light weino or higgsino annihilates too much and undercloses. So to get relic density from dark matter, you need a light beano either annihilating through some very, very light beano annihilating through light state, and the precise region where this works is just above the left bounds for the slepton, or you need some mixed or co-annihilating scenarios where the beano is near a weino, near a higgsino, or near a stout. These are all fairly qualitative things that you can try to look for. So let's consider a world, and in this universe, this is the spectrum of BSM physics that they'll discover in their LHC. And this is what they could conclude from early data. I claim, and I'll go through it briefly. They could probably establish that this is more consistent with the heavy squark template that I showed you than with the light squark template, heavy gluino. Probably establish that the gluino is almost entirely decaying to the third generation, place some tight limit on the first and second generation decay modes, and show that there's not much of a lepton cascade. Extremely probable. Now, so let's start with the first claim, a heavy squark. I'm just going to outline this. None of these are claims that one can do any particular analysis or reach a conclusion in a certain amount of data. But most of the plots I'm going to show you are 100 inverse picobarns PGS, statistical errors only. So ramp that up to whatever luminosity you think is appropriate for real significance. So the one constraint you have, the simplest, not necessarily the most reliable, is from the number of jets in the events. if you get rid of squirk pair and associated production, which have more jets per event, you end up with a lopsided distribution. Of course, this is too quick to say you must have heavy squirks decaying to gluinos, because there's other ways to fix that distribution, like making the gluino decay to tops all the time. But when you do that, you mess up other distributions too. In this case, for example, you overpopulate high lepton multiplicities quite severely. So, I mean, you need to run through all the possibilities to actually come to any conclusions, check many distributions. I'm just going to give you a sort of sampling of the arguments that are constraining that could plausibly tell you this information. Another point I claim that these physicists in that universe can make is that the gluino decays mostly to the third generation quarks. And if you just look at the multiplicity of tag jets, you see that even a 20% fraction of a decay to a light mode would be pretty clearly visible. Again, subject to real limitations of analysis, which I'm not including here. So let's say we reach this. This is sort of a basic characterization that one can try to reach. And I think that's the starting point for layer two of questions. Layer two, if you're singularly obsessed with dark matter, is to think about what the other possibilities are for the SU2 part of the spectrum, which we still haven't constrained very much. So one, for example, could there be a light wino? Well, I already talked about one signature of a light wino, which is this direct squirk decay. It's a little difficult to tease out of the data, but there are kinematic differences between that and the dominant processes involving, for example, the hardest untagged jet, the number of jets, and so on. One could try to distinguish that. And setting a limit on that at, you know, around the 20% level really excludes all cases with a light wino and a left-handed squirk. That's just a chunk of parameter space that you can cut out by this reasoning with one measurement. Now, another scenario we can entertain is a light beano. How do we explain the decays to third generation quarks? Well, maybe the third generation squarks are significantly lighter than the first two generations. They might even be on shell. But there's a singular feature here, because there's no chargino. So there's no decay to a bottom and a top on one side of the decay chain. Only two bottoms or two tops, and that constrains the lepton counts. This is the same scenario I showed you earlier. And this is just an example of the constraints for one particular choice of branching fractions, where you get too few events with one lepton and far too many with many leptons out of this ansatz. To make it work consistent, you really need to add these charge modes where some of the charge is going into a soft W, off-shell W, that we don't see. And the lepton signs are also useful pieces of information. So if you can exclude these two scenarios, then already dark matter really, thermal LSP dark matter has sort of one last stand. There can't be a light wino, and it can't be just the beano plus the slepton to make dark matter work. So a beano LSP with a nearby Higgsino is the only viable case left for thermal dark matter. But what can we do with that? Well, this is fairly model dependent, and it depends on details that you had to measure before. In this case, for example, our bottom and top fractions, based on the lepton counts I showed you earlier, suggest domination by a charged Higgsino. Well, when you have two states like this with a neutral bottom state, that charge always comes back through the cascade decays. So these things actually fit right back into the 2 and the 4 lepton bins, and we probably wouldn't be able to reproduce the charge distributions here either. On the other hand, if you were dominated by production of neutral Higgsinos, these, when they decay to a beano, have a strong preference for going through an off-shell Z. It would have to be off-shell in this case to make the dark matter work, and because the degeneracy in the unit is pretty small. And so you would expect to see a kinematic endpoint in the dileptron mass. And then another thing that would be very useful in constraining this is strong decays of the gluino to light generations. Now, all of these the implications are extremely model dependent. And you shouldn't be surprised that I can't rule out MSSM dark matter without being careful about the MSSM. But the point here is that I can do it, that I can be careful about two things separately. I can be careful about MSSM parameter space on the one hand, and try to make very model independent statements about the data on the other. And then feed those model-independent limits into a more general analysis. So I hope I've at least given you a flavor of that. And I think in this hypothetical universe, I created a few process-level constraints. Would put a lot of pressure, at the very least. I don't know if it could exclude thermal dark matter. This might be too strong a statement. But it could at least put a few strong constraints on the process-level character of the data, of the underlying physics, and pressure the MSS thermal dark matter into a few points with really different and sharp predictions for the annihilation modes of dark matter, for nuclear recoil, and so on. And this probably isn't our scenario. We won't want to do exactly this analysis, but I think a similar kind of hypothesis testing will be useful and fruitful in our universe once we learn more about it. So in summary, I think this characterization, model-independent, process-level characterization of early data could be a really useful stepping stone in understanding the physics of the TEV scale. And I just want to end on a broadly optimistic note that there's probably a lot to see and also a lot to learn about in terms of really fundamental physics in conceivably as early as the first year of running. Thanks.
Questions? Comments? Everybody's hungry. Then, what?
It was the first.
I presume by now you've done this type of analysis with a couple of other cases, and or at least started to look at them. And I'm curious to know something about what kinds of, I mean, obviously for a talk like this, you're going to give us a success story, and that's appropriate. But what kinds of problems do you run into also when you try to do this more in cases that might feel more challenging?
All right. Well, probably the biggest failure has been actually a fairly simple example with very long cascade decays involving lots of leptons. And this is something that, back when I was a grad student at Harvard, I worked on with, I shouldn't name collaborators when telling failure stories. but we saw what looked like very clear resonances and just completely misinterpreted them. They were actually very squeezed kinematic edges, where the LSP was just always coming off with very little momentum. So it really looked like a fairly narrow resonance. So there's certainly a danger when you don't know what model to use, that things smell too much like the wrong model. And I actually think that's an important reason to keep an open mind, because in our case, the model that we were given was SUSY, and we interpreted it as non-SUSY by being fooled by the data. But it's also easy to interpret non-SUSY models as SUSY, and one would want to avoid leaning too heavily in that direction. There have been other cases where, I mean, I think I probably showed you a fairly optimistic case in terms of the ability to really resolve features. I think the dominant failure mode is that things are confusing and you just can't figure out that much early on. There's just a lot of ambiguity.
Anybody else? Okay, if not, let's thank Natalia again. And we come back at 2:00.